Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Unknowingly, we are part of a collective of similar thinking and similar curiosity. What do Google searches say about who we really are? From moments of crisis to curiosity, celebration to confusion, the questions we type into that little search bar reveal more than we might think. My guest today, Simon Rogers. He's Google's data editor and author of What We Ask Google, a surprisingly hopeful history of humankind. He dives into two decades of Google Trends data to uncover patterns in human behavior and what they tell us about our fears, hopes, and shared curiosity. It's a fascinating and surprisingly optimistic look at humanity through the lens of what we search. What We Ask Google, a surprisingly hopeful history of humankind, is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Simon, go to simonrogers.net, and you can follow him on Instagram and X. And Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ira. So nice to be here.
Pleasure. And of course, the most important question I have to ask right at the beginning, is it data or data?
Data.
Thank you, because that's data. What I've been saying, but sometimes
it has to be.
Yeah, it has to be.
I'm so glad you asked me that. I really am obsessed with this. Otherwise, it would be datum. You start getting into datum and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, excellent. And probably the other question that we should, right at the very beginning, and for my viewers and listeners, you can hear my voice slightly going due to pollen. They're aware every year this happens. But we'll continue and we'll get through this. I know we'll be fine. What is, for the novices, because not everybody listening or watching knows, what is Google Trends?
So Google Trends is the world's biggest accessible data set. Anybody can look at it by going to trends.google.com. And essentially, it's a sample of all of the Google searches we do. And they're all kind of anonymized. And essentially, you can see geography down to city level, but no lower. So it gives you basically a kind of an overall aggregated view of what we search for. And you can see how we search at different times of the year in the same ways and the kinds of things that we look for every day.
You don't look like a data guy to me. You look like a normal
person. Well, my secret is that I hated maths at school. Uh-huh. I became a journalist because I didn't want to do anything to do with math. But I kind of got sucked into it when I was at The Guardian back in the day, partly because I loved trying to understand why things happened. And it coincided with this huge kind of influx of public data out there. And I just got into telling stories with data, which is what I do.
And it's the world's largest publicly available data set. It's two decades of our collective brain, in essence, that you write about. And I guess we have to think it through for a second, because I love the title, because it doesn't sound ominous, which every time I think of data, I get a little nervous. I don't want people collecting data on me, you know.
Sure, of course.
So I've changed my name to Anonymous, and hopefully that will help a little bit. But when you first put this all together, were you surprised that there was so much information and maybe so much commonality among humans of various cultures?
Yeah, I didn't start off wanting to write an optimistic book. I absolutely didn't. It was something that just kind of came out of the data. And for me, it started with I wrote the chapter about grief first. When I wrote the book, it was just after my mama died. Mm. And I was searching for everything, because this was a new experience for me. As a club, we all eventually join, unfortunately. But basically, I was looking for everything. And when you go through something like that, you feel very alone. Like, you must be the only person in the world experiencing this thing, even though logically you know that millions of other people have gone through the same thing. And when you look at the data around the way we search, I could see that I wasn't the only person looking for these things, whether it's about dreams or about how I feel, or there were millions of other people doing the same thing. And so you feel alone when you're searching for, you know, how you're feeling. And when I started looking at the data, because I thought, I'm Google's data editor, I can look at how we search, I realized I wasn't the only person doing it. And that feeling of that, actually, you know, while we're living in a world where we know there's a crisis of loneliness going on right now, that people feel lonely, you're not actually alone in this moment. That whatever you're doing, there are other people doing the same thing. And there was something reassuring about that to me. So it's very much, it kind of came out of the data, and it was a very organic, real thing that I saw happening. And that's how it ended up being optimistic. It wasn't, I didn't start with that way, although people tell me I'm an optimistic person, but yeah, that's, it came out of the data.
I have to tell you, my first reaction when we before we talked and before we began the conversation was, I'm just delighted there's a human behind all of this data. In other words, you. And so people don't look, because we always think of Google and other search engines as very impersonal instruments. Sure. So that alone is optimistic for me, at any rate, perhaps some listeners and viewers as well. When you started to write the book, clearly it's not just focused on the reason you first started going and looking at when your mom died, and we're sorry about that, but it led you to decide to write the book. So were there other factors involved in writing the book in terms of what you're finding out in Google Trends?
Yeah, so basically I was concerned, I wanted it to feel like a book. I didn't want it to feel like just a book of lists, although there are lots of lists and data in there. But I think it was this idea that actually there is a big focus on technology. Great, you know, a lot of books about tech are about the tech, but not so often about the humans and about how basically the way that we search, what it says about us as humans. And what it seems to me is that there is something I've just not seen anybody do before around fact, for instance, we search for help more than any time in history. Whenever there's a crisis, people search for how to donate blood. And there's also this kind of shared, very human experience. I wanted it to feel like it was about the stuff that we all go through every day. So there's chapters on parenting, on pets, on food, on grief, and science, and so on. And partly also, it came out of this thing that I haven't really seen elsewhere, is how we have this kind of shared commonality around things. So whether it's like about 2 a.m. every morning, you will see spike in search of the words baby and sleep, for instance. Or even things that, there's one trend that I highlight early in the book, and that has always really kind of been something, I actually have this printed out on my desk, that during a hurricane, what you'll see is a spike in searches for how to calm a dog in a storm. And to me, you know, it makes sense to see spikes in searches for how to, you know, block my windows or how to get, you know, store water or whatever. But seeing that very human search about something that's not ourselves, that to me was really beautiful, and I wanted to write something about that.
When you look at Google Trends and you look at artificial intelligence and some of the tools that are involved, when I use artificial intelligence, AI, I call it my personal assistant, because it's the same as a Google search, but in a way the format's slightly different, and you sometimes have to refine the question or the prompt in order to get the answer. But I find that I don't think it makes a human less knowledgeable by having resources such as Google Trends or just looking something up on Google. We're attached at the hip at this point. Let me use that metaphor, in the sense that so many things that before we would have to ask a neighbor, a friend, and they didn't know, we'd have to go to the library or we'd have to hire an expert or whatever. And now through a search bar, we can find anything we need as an answer, generally speaking. I'm sure there's some things that are unanswerable, like why am I doing this podcast? But aside from that, that would be one of those metaphysical questions that I don't think Google can answer. But I guess what I'm saying is, it's part of your title too, the humanizing factor of it. You're relying on a non-human entity to help you be a more effective human. Do you get that sense when you were writing the book?
Definitely. I mean, I think that, I guess if anybody doesn't take just a couple of things away from the book, one of which is, you know, we're not alone. We're all in the same boat, whether or not we know it. Second thing is, there's also this kind of shared experience around helping and mutual aid, which is something that I didn't expect to see as much as I did. And then the other thing which really strikes home with me is, we don't know anything. We need help with absolutely everything in our daily lives. Even things like the top food search is how to boil an egg. and is always the top food search, and is consistently top food search, which suggests to me that people have to search for it repeatedly. And it's like, and some of the things that we search about and help with are like, they make sense, like how to tie a tie. I mean, who wears a tie nowadays?
Right. But one I can understand, Simon. How to boil an egg. If you don't know how to boil an egg at a certain age, how do you even know to use Google search?
I know. But it's like, I suppose there's an honesty to the way we search, because, you know, when you search for something, you're not presenting yourself in the way you are on social media. Right. You're just expressing genuine interest. And then there's also things in there which are kind of sweet, actually, like how to know if somebody likes me, you know, how to kiss, these things that people just, you know, don't know. And in the past, maybe they would have asked Agni aunts, you know, is the phrase in the UK. I don't know what the phrase in the US is. But essentially now, like, people ask the web, because we ask for everything. Right. And sometimes it's about how to fix things as well. And you can see even like geographical differences in the way people search for how to repair and fix things in their lives too, whether it's light bulbs or broken windows.
I'm 98.6% paranoid. So my question to you is very important. When you're doing a Google search, is there some place within the universe in the Google servers, et cetera, that retains the fact that I asked that question and it will come back to haunt me 10 years from now?
So Google Trends data is basically, it's a sample of searches. Everything is basically, the only data you can see in Google Trends is location by city.
Right.
Not even any more local than that.
But separate from Google Trends, though, is there some backup system within Google that knows
exactly? Yeah, no, there's a whole set of laws around data retention and stuff.
Okay, because I don't want to be embarrassed 10 years from now when it turns out that I ask, how do I boil an egg? You know,
your egg searches are private.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Simon. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Sounds somewhat non sequitur, or non-linear, but that's kind of the way I do things a little bit, but just so people get a sense of your background, because you mentioned that you weren't looking that much into math in the very beginning in terms of your background, but you were with Twitter, now X, and I'll be quiet and let you fill in for people that are interested in reading your book. And again, it's called What We Ask Google, A Surprisingly Hopeful History of Humankind. But what brought you to that place in terms of Google? You were obviously, you were with Twitter for a while, but what was your background?
So I worked at The Guardian for about 15 years, and I did a number of jobs there.
And by the way, for our listeners and viewers that may not know about The Guardian, it's a British newspaper.
Yeah, British newspaper, global website now. It's got a pretty big global presence. And I joined to launch the website, the news website, basically. That was the first launch editor there. And I then moved to the paper. And actually, my first day on the paper was September the 10th, 2001, as a news editor. So obviously, the world changed after that. But there was a real demand for data. And what we saw was a ton of data out there. And I just got into the space where I was the person in the newsroom, started working with data. From there, I set up a blog called the Guardian's Data Blog. And from there, I got a job at Twitter in San Francisco. I thought it'd be great to move here with the kids, so to give them the experience of living in on the West Coast and having been based in London. And so basically, got into this weird space where essentially my role is really not internal analysis, but much more thinking about what that data can say about us in a particular place. So I worked at Twitter when it was Twitter, around 2013 for a couple of years. And then I got offered this job at Google, which is very much fitting to my skills, I guess, like working with data to tell the stories, make that data available. And, you know, we work with newsrooms, we work with NGOs, we work with any organization really that wants to use Google Trends in that way. And it's an incredibly powerful data set, I think.
And you mentioned in the beginning again, Simon, about how to access Google Trends. So that's Google.
That's trends.google.com.
Right, yeah. Trends.google.com. When, sorry to cut you off there, but we have a slight delay. So I always think someone's done talking and they're not, or vice versa.
Not so.
It does happen. When you decided to write the book and structure it, how did you decide how it would be structured? In other words, the chapters, the approach, et cetera. You gave us the sense of why you started this process, which was about your mom. But how did you then go from there to go, okay, here's how I'm going to break this up so that normal humans can understand this, which is what your skill is in writing this?
Well, thank you. I mean, basically, for me, I was thinking, what are the everyday moments, the things that we all share? So it very much kind of follows that structure where I talk about time and I talk about even the weather at some point, but then also food or parenting or pets. And honestly, I was thinking around my life. I mean, I always think that, you know, if you're writing about something that you care about, there'll be somebody else out there who cares about it too. So it's very much based around those everyday moments. And it's designed to feel approachable and accessible in that way. This isn't data as this remote thing that people feel is not connected to their lives. And this is the most human data there is, but it's weird data. It's weird. It's weird because firstly, it's very changeable, changes every second. It's utterly ephemeral. And one moment we care about a football game, the next we care about a celebrity, the next we care about the news. So it changes constantly. So there are trends in the book which are almost like ghosts. They're things that show up, and they show up at that moment in time, but then they will disappear. It's a huge data set. So it's available in the book, it's like people talk in the data world about quantitative and qualitative mm-hmm. as being two different things. The quantitative is basically like a survey where you've got numbers, and qualitative would be like a focus group. And in a way, with Google Trends data, it is qualitative data, but in quantitative quantities.
Right.
If that makes sense. So it's basically...
Surprisingly, I actually understand you. Which is your great gift.
Yay. So basically, it's just a huge data set, and it's weird and ever-changing. And because of that, it's something that we just have to kind of to look at in a different way. So it tells us things in the moment. And as I say in the book, like some of the stuff in the book may well be utterly different by the time people read it than when I found it. But it's right. It's designed to feel like what I'm trying to do is bring kind of proper analytical techniques to telling a human and behavioral story.
What was the most surprising thing you found when researching this book and writing it? Was there one or two things that changed your mind about either humans or technology or both?
Gosh, so the thing about working with trends data for over a decade now is that nothing really surprises me. Although having said, there are odd things in there, like the spike in search of people wanting to keep pandas as pets, which feels like... you're not going to be able to keep a panda as a pet. I just want to tell you, world, that's not going to happen.
Yes, I think so.
And then, but there was one particular search, which it kind of took me down a bit of a journey, which I was looking around languages and the phrase how to say, because what we'll often do is we'll say how to say something in French or how to say something in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And there was a spike in search, and I looked at, say, searches around saying thank you, because there's something... you know, very global about the way we want to say thank you for things. And there was this weird little spike, which was how to say thank you for an unexpected gift, which basically was the highest place when I was pulling the data that showed that trend was in Niger. Now, Niger is like a country in Africa I don't know anything about. I'm not ashamed to admit it. A little bit less than I know about Nigeria. I don't know anybody from Niger. And so I was just really curious about this. And also it was a French speaking country, former French colony.
And I think they also pronounce it Niger too, sometimes depending on where you are in the world.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think in France it's Niger and Niger is a French speaking country. So why would this search in English be spiking? Well, Niger has also been through a lot, had the civil war. You know, is this like aid workers searching for it and so on? And so I thought, well, I really need to speak to somebody who knows something about Niger. So I contacted the Nigerian embassy, no response. There's a US consulate in Niger, couldn't get through to them. And eventually I found a Nigerian who is basically NASA's top hydrologist, is from Niger, to Fatima Minor.
Interesting.
And I just messaged her. I said, I'm really sorry. This isn't about hydrology or any of the amazing qualifications you have, but could you help me with this trend? And she wrote back straight away, to her credit. and just explaining that there is a tradition of gift giving in Niger, but to the extent that even if you don't have anything, you'll always make sure you've got a gift. If you go around somebody's house, even if it's just like an egg or something. And to me, that was just a really lovely insight into life in another part of the world that I would never have been able to find out otherwise.
And of course, if you do have an egg, you have to know how to boil it. So that's why the second search comes up.
Indeed. Yes.
Well, no, that's a great insight into a culture that you may not be aware of before as to why all of a sudden something's spiking as a question. And you were able to track it down. Did you feel a little bit like a detective in some of those cases where you're not getting an answer to something initially that should have been simple, and you, as you finally discovered this scientist was able to answer your question about the gift?
In a way, thank you. That's a really good question, because in a way it's a little bit like being an archaeologist, that you're constantly kind of uncovering the stuff that nobody's ever seen before. Nobody really knows how to analyze it. It's brand new data. What does it mean when there's a search or a spike in searches? Nobody really knows that yet, because it's new. I mean, we didn't have Google Trends data beyond like weekly until a few years ago. We've had real time only for the last few years. So it's a brand new science. And so, often I feel like an archaeologist discovering something that's never been seen before.
Well, the other interesting thing, too, is you're not basing it on a snapshot of a Google search. You're not basing it on 1 month, 1 year. It's 20 years. So you're looking at the broader term or relatively broader term in terms of what the trends are.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself, you're relatively young, do you see yourself 20 years from now doing the second book about the next 20 years? So 40 years of Google, what do you think?
I mean, let's see how this one goes. Thank you. I mean, I had a lot of fun writing this. I really enjoyed it. But the obviously the big change now is how we're searching. You know, will AI change the way that we search? And we're already seeing some suggestions that is the case. There's a kind of bit of revolution of the way we search going on right now. Will it change what we search about? That is the big question. Because there has been this consistency over the last 20 years. You know, like, so now, for instance, people are searching longer queries. Mm-hmm. They're much longer. Before, you might have said, find me a restaurant near me. And now you might say, find me a Vietnamese restaurant where I can take a birthday cake and a bottle of wine to celebrate my mom's birthday. You know, like, you can get really detailed. And there's also, now there's this kind of cognitive offloading, which, by that I mean that, basically, we will kind of, in the past, we would go down that rabbit hole. And now what we would do is ask AI to go down that rabbit hole for us.
Right.
So whether it's like, you know, you're organizing your financial planning or something like that, you would now ask AI to help do that for you rather than going to all those websites and having that experience you would have done in the past. So there are changes in the way that we look for things, for sure.
And I think, too, that I know, for example, I asked about somebody on AI, and initially they gave me one answer, and then I realized I hadn't framed the question exactly the way I wanted. So I reframed the question,
right,
and I got the accurate answer. Because they didn't know who this person was, but then they did when I added an extra little fact or on it. So that as well. By the way, just for people who are watching us versus listening, okay, those listening may occasionally hear a little sound. Those watching get a chance to see a delightful dog. So I just want to point that out.
This is Biscuit, who unfortunately, we're recording this at the very time that the postman comes to the house. And Biscuit, although he doesn't look fierce, he is, there you go, protector of the house.
Excellent. I want to introduce Biscuit to the group. So when you finally, how did you know when you would be finishing the book? What I mean by that is, how did you know when the end comes? Because it's infinite, really, in terms of trends. You could go on forever, like the rabbit hole you talked about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to, it's a really good question. I'm good at having deadlines, because this is the thing about working in the newsroom, that you live on deadlines. Right. So I set myself a deadline. We'd agreed like 50,000 words. And once I got into it, I also set myself some time. I actually went to stay in a cottage, I guess, in the middle of the Yucca Valley, which is just north of Palm Springs, kind of right in the desert. And I knew I had to, I'm going to write a certain amount of words per day. So I had to kind of give it some structure, and this is probably a me thing. But I wanted to end on this idea around help. With the last chapter is about helping and helping others and what that means in search. So that was for me, that was the end of this chapter of the book, essentially, was to look at that. Now, if I was to redo it today, and you know, the book industry is so weird because you write a book a year before it's going to be published. So, and it just sits there. So I've been adding stuff to make sure it keeps up to date, because in the last year, the world has changed. You know, AI has utterly changed how we do everything. And I wanted the book to reflect that. So I think that would be, if I was writing it again, I mean, I would like that. Maybe that's the next chapter, to do, you know, what we ask AI.
I like that. Oh, you come back on the show at that point. Before I let you go, though, Simon, what would you like readers to take from the book? Is there one or two essential elements that you'd like people to take from the book?
I think just those big points that, you know, you might feel lonely, but you're not alone. You are part of a community, whether you know it or not, who is interested in and doing the same things. Second thing is that we may feel like the world is insane right now and that people are terrible, but that's not what I see in the data. What I see in the data is people wanting to do the right thing. And so I think we're all probably a little bit better than we think we are.
Yeah, that's good.
And then, we don't know anything and we're not ashamed to ask for help. And asking for help is a good thing, I'd say.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Simon Rogers. He's the author of What We Ask Google, A Surprisingly Hopeful History of Humankind. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookshop.org, and all the usual places. For everything about Simon, go to simonrogers.net, simonrogers.net. You could follow him on Instagram and X. And Simon, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel. Let me do that again. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.